We're going to start the final session of the day, changing format a little bit. Instead of having presentations up here, we're going to have discussions that take place at the table. And the first two people to do that are going to be Tony Barboza, Anthony Barboza, and Bill Gaskins. Tony Barboza is a photographer and artist best known for his portraits of African-American musicians, although that's only a tiny tip of his iceberg. He's been photographing since the 1960s. He's a leading member and recently president of the Kaminge Workshop, which is a cooperative what we talked about earlier today. Still going on, right? It lives on. He's also worked commercially for places like the New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Black Enterprise, other magazines, worked in advertising, and done record album covers, had many exhibitions, and is in a collection here at the Rare and Manuscript Collections, has more than 2,000 photographs and related materials. A book of these portraits of jazz, well, I guess of portraits of all sorts, was published in 1980 called Black Borders, if you want to look that up. He'll be speaking with Bill Gaskins, who's a should be familiar to many of you in the Cornell community. He's associate visiting professor in the Department of Art and in the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning, and a faculty member in the American Studies program, where he teaches a number of innovative courses that, if there are any students in the audience, you should definitely take a course with Bill before time goes on. And his work can be seen in the book Good and Bad Hair. Speaking of hair. So they'll discuss, and then we'll have a short changeover and get on to the next people. So Bill and Tony.
Thanks you all for being here. Thanks to Kate Adelman, Frankel, and Andy Grunberg for inviting me and Tony to be part of this, as well as B.J. Needham's for the work that he does here every day at the museum, and alumni affairs officers Mike O'Neill and Adam Mertlin for live streaming the event today. That's really important that we're getting this outside of the Finger Lakes. So I want to begin with a quote by Talani Davis from the foreword to the exhibition catalog For All the World to See, Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights. Quote, "What if history granted white America only one or two individuals in each era to stand as its representative, the summation of its character, accomplishments, and perhaps all that the world would know of white America?" When I put this question to a white friend, he asked what I meant by represent. My friend could have also asked, represent white America to whom? The representation of African Americans in the cultural mainstream, however, has been so selective, narrowly conceived, and determined by anticipation of white reception that widely accessible black images also become iconic. Most of them still exist in a shorthand of African American fame rather than history. Most people can call up an image of any famous black person as representative of what Talani Davis talks about. Anthony Barboza is a human archive, library, collection, and collection who has done some extraordinary work. And I wouldn't be sitting here in this role as photographer, scholar, professor if not for the work that I saw him do. When I was a teenager. Don't mean age you like that, bro, but you know, it was like that. So this was Mr. Barboza at a time in his life that was probably not unlike mine. He had significantly more cameras than I did. Tell us about this.
Well, when I came to New York and when I was 19 and, in 1963, the first major event that happened in American history happened 2 months after I arrived, and that was the assassination of Kennedy. And I spent 2 years here, I mean in New York, and I belonged to the Kamonge Workshop, which is a group of black photographers started in 1963, and it is to this day the longest running group in the history of photography, nonprofit, anyway. But then I got drafted in the Army for Vietnam, and I ran to the Navy so I could spend less time. And I got out as quickly as I could. And what happened was that I had some experience in those 2 years of doing photography. But after boot camp, the Navy gave me structural mechanic. So for some odd reason, I put up some photographs in a sidewalk art festival, and I was immediately transferred to the lab. I never got to school. And I worked there for a few months, and they decided, well, they put me as a station newspaper photographer. So I spent that time there and was transferred to Jacksonville after Pensacola. And I got out as quickly as I could. Matter of fact, Julia was waiting for me to get out because in 68, when I got out, Julie was going to the New York Public Library. We found that coincidence. So from then on, I was still a member of Kamonge, and the thing is that when I was in the Navy, I would do photographing on my spare time all over the Florida. And I was always about doing photographs of us. Now, it was a passion more than anything else. I wanted to record what was down south as much as I could. The Navy found out about me doing a story on a poor family, and I was told to not do it anymore, and there was nothing I could do about it. So at least I stopped doing the family, but I still went around doing photography. And what it was is that I was really anxious to get out so I could go back to the group. Now, I didn't go to college, but this was my college, and it's pronounced Kamonge, and it's a Kikuyu word meaning working together. And we did work together. It was my education. We listened to music to the point of listening to jazz that we could, I learned how to differentiate between each musician, their style. We criticized photographs every week. Someone would put up photographs and some people would start crying because everybody had an opinion about it. But we learned a lot more about photography that way. Roy DiCarapa was the guiding light at that time. Now, if he was the guiding light, he had experienced so many years of doing that before we were even born. Matter of fact, he was born the same year, I think, as my father. But he instilled in us that in that beginning we should not go around shooting homeless people. We wanted to dignify our own race in that sense, to show a positive light about it. And this went on for many years, even after I got out of the Navy. But one day, I had a studio at that time. Cornell Kappa came, and he wanted us to be in the first exhibit for ICP, along with Mark Ribot. So we gave that exhibit. He came, and we talked with him, and we had a group of guys that were very, what I would call, opinionated about certain things. And he would sit there and listen to us. Some of us were hard to get along with because we had our opinions set on how we wanted to represent us and our own people. So that went on for a while, but we got the exhibit. As a matter of fact, in that year, I think that I decided I would do a special project for that. So it was like walking the streets, because we all did that. We used to call it ash can photography. I would shoot all full-length portraits of people in the city, New York. And that's what I put up at that time. But each person in the group had a certain style, but everything came from the ideas that Roy started. Now, why I mention certain things is that, okay, I listened to all the curators, but I didn't hear much about how the photographer felt about what he was doing. Was it his passion? Did he really love it? Or was he doing it for money? What was he thinking? Where did he learn his craft from? Or did he just wait a few minutes before he took that one shot? Did he look around? Those are very important because as a photographer, I'm always feeling and thinking at the same time. It is not a separate thing. It is not an aggressive thing where you take up the camera. I'm feeling out everything that's going on. And that is so important that you have to really talk to photographers that you are curating their work. It's very meaningful. I mean, they are thinking like anybody else, but a lot of them are feeling. I don't know how many are feeling. Some are very aggressive, and maybe they ain't feeling. I mean, there's been a lot of aggressive photographers going to get the shot, and it has nothing to do with how he feels about it. It's almost like he's taking a photograph of someone, and he's using that person for his own ulterior motives. There's a lot of difference between those two things.
So
the ulterior motives are very, I've seen a lot of photographers very aggressive. I mean, I used to sit in clubs and shoot jazz, but sometimes I would just sit there and just listen to the music and not photograph every minute and every second poking a camera in the face, you know. And I always think that, you know, when I learned photography from Kamongi, we listened to music, we talked about art, we talked about literature, we did all that through all this writing. I mean, from Baldwin to Julio Cortaz, different people. And we watched a lot of movies, especially Buñuel, and my favorite, Exterminating Angel. All right. So, okay, I'm sorry.
No. I was going to sit over there and, you know, ask you questions from there. But as it relates to Kamongi, and I'm going to say one name, and I know that's going to be another another solo on your part, and it's cool. Lewis Draper. the role, talk about the role that Lewis Draper played in, you know, what became the energy, the zeitgeist of Kamange and the goals that you and the other members had. And you talk about Kamange being your academy, your college, mm-hmm. and the role that Lou Draper played in your development.
Okay, well, when I met Lou, he was a very unassuming person, you know. We used to walk the streets together, and we always wrapped the camera on, but we had to be really quick. But the main thing that I learned from Lou is the morals of subjects, you know, and how important reading is and art and studying the history of photography and what everybody else was doing. So he was like a role model in a sense that his main thing was the morals of what we are doing. He was more important to me than Roy. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, there's one thing that I objected to with a lot of Kamange members, but some have come out of it. Okay, when you learn from a teacher, you copy a teacher. And you can't copy a teacher. So you fall into the same vein. So I decided a long time ago that, well, okay, I will just evolve from what I learned and do other ways of, use other ways of approaching a project. So I would spend 9 years doing each project. And I wanted to transcend my mind and my thinking into the images, but not just the street. I love doing things in the street, but I did them for a long time, even when I got out of the Navy. And it became to a point that I began to see surrealistically the images, that it wasn't just what was going on in the scene, but there was something else beyond that in my mind that was saying something else. And that something else was my feeling in my mind, thinking about. It could be anything, but it's hard to describe what I mean without a visual image. I don't think you have any here. Those are earlier years. So it became to a point that I was seeing and becoming autobiographical about my thinking. It became something that was what you learn through your life, is that everything that you do in your life is collecting a lot of things in your mind, and it makes decisions that quick, because when you're that quick with the flick and the shutter, it's because something else is telling you something, and you're feeling something else from within you, which is very interesting. And not many people talk about that. So it became to the point that if I went through that, then I came to what you'll show now, the subjects in which I tried to make another dimension in a single plane, that something beyond, and with the lighting, of doing lighting in the studio, it represented certain things to me about that particular person and how I felt about that person.
But before we get to that, okay, I think what's important for everyone to appreciate is that Anthony Barboza single-handedly changed the way that African-American, Caribbean-American, Latin-American people were imaged through advertising and editorial photography during the 70s when three men and one woman came together to create Essence Communications Incorporated, which led to Essence Magazine. And this is where I first saw this man's work. And even in the context of a magazine, One of the things that made Tony Barbosa stand out from everybody was this really narrative approach that he took to editorial fashion as well as editorial portraiture. And he played a significant role in this woman's career. This is, anybody know who this is? You didn't know it was going to be a test, did you?
She came to my studio and wanted to be a model.
Pull up to the bumper, baby.
And she said, nobody will test me.
It's her.
And I said, well, yeah, I'll photograph you. And I tried to, you know, do photographs of her and get her involved. And there's a certain rapport between the model and the photographer. I cannot explain it.
Tell them who it is.
Oh, yes. So, anyway, it's Grace Jones in the beginning of her career. And then I gave her her first job with Essence. And it's funny now that she had a book come out not too long ago, and she dedicated a whole page to me in doing the first photographs of her. But it's interesting that... you see, I'm not only, whenever I'm working, I'm trying to inspire what I feel about that person. And even while I was here, I got an email from a model in the 60s that said, thank you for the years that you encouraged me because I was too short to be a model, but you gave me some jobs. I was in shock. There are certain people through the years. Some of them have been in movies that I encouraged and inspired to go on. And then I met this girl. It was in her 60s, about 68 or 69, I think it was. And she came up, and I did photographs of her. And she said, Tony, I want to... cut my hair and go bald. I said, you shouldn't do that. You won't get any work. But she did it, and we both got work. So it was she was the first model in the history of fashion to go bald. And she had a great career, and we had news companies come from as far as Australia and France and do some filming of us that we never even saw.
She worked with Isaac Hayes, too, didn't she?
Well, no, she didn't work with him. She just did a shooting. We put her in a shooting with Isaac Hayes. Yeah, for Essence. I didn't explain why I went into commercial photography. First of all, when I got out of the Navy, I couldn't get any work. I tried to be an assistant, and they said, well, you're going to experience. And I said, that's what I'm here for. And I couldn't get hired. So I said, well, I'll try and do it myself. So I just started that way. And the first portfolio I had of fashion was I was hired by Harper's Bazaar to do the shop by mail and make $125 a month. But it was a start until I got the, after a couple of years, they let me do the fashion in the middle. But it happened that the two women who were the art directors quit, and the next guy who came in to be the art director said, we won't have any black photographer working here anymore. So I could never work for them again, so I went to Essence.
So talk about the representation of blackness in magazines, in fashion, in news during the time you were...
Well, when I was asked to do fashion, you know, I started thinking about, you know, walking the streets and doing photographs. So now it came a time that they asked me to do a shooting of, fashion. And I said, well, why don't we do it in Harlem? It's never been done for a magazine before. So I decided that I would do like a little mini series of about 7 photographs that end up being, I think, 1 in color and then the rest in black and white. And without a storyboard, but it was like shooting a storyboard, I directed the 2 men that were trying to pick up the 2 women on the street. So I went through that sequence of directing them. See, I did a lot of directing of my fashion shoots, even in the studio. Don't ask me how, because I could never take directions myself. So that's what happened. And what I was trying to do is bring our culture, because that's our culture, but we're wearing these clothes. So we want to show the clothes, but we want people to relate to what we know about our culture, which is very important. I mean, before that, they would put a model, a black model in the magazine, and she'd have on the clothes, and she'd sit there and just move, and, you know, that wasn't enough to inspire and have anybody look at it. You can relate better. I remember growing up that my parents would say, oh, there's a black person on TV, so we all want to go see it. You know, so this is the difference. So I remembered those things. Now, also, I mentioned the feeling. So I had to get, they're not actors. You know, most of the models will put their hand on their hip and just move. So I'm running backwards and shooting them and directing them to do this whole idea. I just tell them the idea. Look, there's 2 beautiful women there. You guys got to try and pick them up. So that was easy. That's what we do all the time. So, you know, it worked out. I shot barbershop fashion there. I did a couple of things there, but sometimes they wanted me to do it in the studio, and they wanted to decide, you know, well, we want to do it here, and they wanted their ideas. But a lot of ideas I got through. I did a boxing in a ring with the models at that time. I would do things like that so that they could relate to, you know. There was one different thing is that, you know, when Avedon was doing fashion in Paris, well, he just used Paris as the scene in the back, and the girls would do the same thing. But we see these things and we learn from these, but we go on. It's no use copying somebody or trying to copy somebody. Come with something that's within you and part of you. That's what I always tried to do.
So let's move to something that puts you in context of another period of time, another photographer. The photo nerds in the room will know what this is. Those of you who don't, this is the cover to the Gallery of Illustrious Americans. It was a portfolio of 20 photographs, or rather engravings, based on photographs by the photographer Matthew Brady. And it was, in his words, a compendium of the greatest exponents of American culture. So, Mr. Barboza decides during the 1980s to...
Well, before that.
Really before that, but yeah. In terms of the publishing of the book, it was 1980s. To publish a body of work that was decades in the making, that was based upon the relationships that he had with illustrious Americans that he had declared. Within African-American culture, and he called it Black Borders. And it was the other side of Anthony Barboza that I got to see before I got to see his work in the Black Photographer's Annual 1973. And the durability of this work over the time between now and then, it is remarkable. It's a master class in not only lighting, but also a master class in how do you get a relationship with a subject within the confines of a studio that doesn't look like it's in the confines of a studio. So you want to talk about what inspired all of these?
Okay, I spent, I think it was 73 or 2, I wanted to do portraits of some of the artists and musicians that inspired me. And I started with a plain background, you know, just a background, put it up. And I said, well, this is getting monotonous. Either I'm going to be shooting like getting quirky looks like Avedon, or I'm going to put him in a corner like Irving Penn. I said, I can't do this and see how they react. So I don't know how it came about. I don't remember. But all of a sudden, I started to work on different lighting, and I would not prepare the shoot and the lighting before the subject. Now, I knew some of the subjects.
This is the painter Norman Lewis.
I knew some of the subjects, but I didn't say, well, I'm going to, the night before, draw out everything, and I'm going to do this lighting. What I did was when they came into the studio, and I've done this through my career, is that you have to be warm with the person because they're in a foreign place to be sitting, they're not in their living room to do a portrait of them. I never knew what it was about me that I was able to transcend and make people feel comfortable in a situation like this. And through the years, I still don't understand it, but I had some movie stars want to take me on a trip with them to photograph them. Eartha Kitt wanted me to meet her daughter. I'm saying, what is going on here? But it was something about feeling the person and understanding their work and then creating the lighting on the spot. This is all on the spot because I also had to learn when I went somewhere to find that same time, where would I photograph this person in their home? So I had to be quick.
Let's talk about Mike.
Okay, so one of them was, I had to shoot Michael Jackson for a magazine called Crawdaddy, and I had to make him dance and do all this stuff. Created lighting for him, but I did the magazine photographs of him dancing, and I said, well, I got time, I'm going to shoot for myself a portrait. And I don't do a lot of thinking. I do more feeling than thinking, so I put the lighting a certain way and cast a shadow like a little boy sitting on a bench. And that was the whole idea of how I felt about him, because the whole time he spent in the studio, his assistant was running back saying, oh, we found there's some photographs of little kids in the newspaper. I said, oh, gee, okay, very interesting. And Janet was little, and she was in the front of the studio, so we had somebody watch her. So it was things like that that just by taking control, he was very shy. But I still made him dance. He was in a foreign place, but I still was able to. And I still don't know how I do it. To this day, I don't know what goes on.
Okay.
So I did the whole series this way. You know, like this one here, he was a dancer for Grace Jones, so I had him do that on the spot. So there's about 160 to 175 different people I photographed. But when I won the grant, I could only do a little booklet of them. But Bill wants to work with me on that, doing the big book.
So if you can find it, the first edition of Black Borders.
Oh, no, you won't be able to find it. Oh, no, there's only 1,500 copies, and I don't have but a few left, and they're about $250 now.
Are you selling them here?
Oh, you have to understand that I went into commercial photography because I didn't want to get another job and be away from photography. So everything helped me to learn about people because I was very shy. So, and I had to make money to pay for my habit, which is my own work. That's why I went into commercial photography. Okay?
You've got a great habit. Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Bill. Am I on? I guess I'm on. There we go. Well, thanks for that. That was fabulous. So we have to move right along. And let me introduce to you Johan Kugelberg and Larry Clark. Larry Clark, probably of all of us, is the person that needs no introduction, but he is the author of the photo books Tulsa, 1971, which was a Lustrum Press book, and Teenage Lust in 1983. And more recently has been making films, first of which I saw in San Francisco in 1995, called Kids. More recently, he's done Marfa Girl and Marfa Girl 2, and he received the Lucy Award for Documentary Photography from the International Center of Photography in 2005. The Kroc Library's Rare and Manuscript Collections here has an archive currently of some 2,800 photographs associated with his books and films, including the dummies or work prints for Tulsa, in addition to books, posters, and skateboard ephemera. He's going to be joined by Johan Kugelberg, who's a great friend of the Rare Manuscript Collection Library, co-founder of Boo Hooray, which is a New York-based space for collections and exhibitions related to Johan's interests in punk, hip-hop, and countercultures. Johan's also a curator, an author, teacher, and man about every town. University of Virginia, you've been there. Yeah. So he has arranged the acquisitions by the library here of the Larry Clark archives I've mentioned, as well as the Cornell hip-hop collection and punk collection, and also arranged the acquisition of work by Joe Conzo Jr., who we will also be speaking about. You're on.
Hello, hello.
Hi. So, Larry, we've been working together for 10, 11, 12 years, whatever it is now, mostly on archiving a living, breathing, constantly producing artists. So on one level, as we're working together, it's all rear view mirror. It's making sense of old work prints and vintage prints and old notebooks and outlines for projects that came about, outlines for projects that didn't come about, looking at, you know, old maquettes and maquette variations at the same time as, and you know, it may sound a bit flattering, but let's go there. Trying to keep up with you as a contemporary producing artist. So how do you feel about me being some sort of Santa's little helper of the way back machine at the same time as dealing with your constant production? Let's start with that one.
It's been good because I have so much stuff. I have no idea how much I have. I mean, really, you know, we like find something new every day. Where it is, whether it's in Oklahoma somewhere, and, you know, who knows.
A pretty illuminating anecdote for that is on the drive up here from New York City this morning, I'm going, Larry, I just found two variant teenage lust maquettes in one of the boxes that we're organizing and processing. And this was particularly fascinating because, of course, the Aperture Foundation were originally supposed to publish Teenage Lust, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And they didn't do it.
They Why? Couldn't.
They couldn't do
they
it.
They couldn't do it because all the lawyers told them that they couldn't.
It was a fancy lawyer, too, right?
There was a fancy lawyer who worked for Playboy out of Chicago. And he came back with a list that, you know, like 40, 50 prints, you know, you couldn't show because they could get sued.
It was like you called somebody's sister crazy.
My sister crazy.
Yeah, your own sister. You
My own
crazy.
Sister. And they said, and you can't sue. Do that because she can sue.
Yeah.
So anyway, they kept seeing lawyers and spending tons of money. And it came down to one photograph. They said, okay, we'll do it, but take out this one photograph. And I said, no.
Of course not. It's like, you know, already in 1983, Larry Clark was Larry Clark.
Right, so.
And that is why you ended up self-publishing Teenage Lust.
Yes, yeah, exactly, because nobody would publish it. But what Johann has done is he has me looking too, and I find things that I don't remember writing or doing, you know.
Or photographing.
I have notebooks about films and stuff when I was a kid. And
I think it's a really important point to make in this setting when you have the great opportunity and the great privilege working with a living, breathing, sometimes kicking, screaming artist, is that your own archive, Larry, is now also informing current work. And you're finding material that you might not have identified when you were putting together This Perfect Childhood in 1991, mm-hmm, or when you were working on Tulsa in 68, 69, as like great work or work that, you know, that reverberates with you as an artist, but then you revisit it like 40 mm-hmm years, 50 years later. Mm-hmm. That's pretty wild.
Well, that's from meeting you and, you know, you being amazed by all this stuff. You would open a box and find an old notebook and say, look at this, and I look and read the notebook, you know.
But you've also had the privilege of being in the same loft for a really long time and also not liking to throw stuff away.
I've been in this loft about 38 years, and I've never thrown anything away, you know.
Over the years, we have also staged a number of archival exhibitions where we have pulled material from your archive and set it either in like a gallery setting or like a museum setting. Mm-hmm. We staged a show in Tokyo. We staged one big show in New York. We
staged one
at MoCA. I can't even remember. Yeah. And that also becomes a part of the process because then it's your journey of discovery. And also, since you work in collages, you're able to pull stuff from your own life and mm-hmm do, you know, three-dimensional collages as well, which becomes another aspect of the work mm-hmm in books.
Mm-hmm.
So, what has been like the most epiphanous events of you diving into your own archive, would you say?
Well, it gives me ideas about making film. You know. I like read stories that I wrote when I was a teenager, and I'd say, man, you know, maybe I can make a film out of it.
Wasn't there like some stuff in both the narrative of Marfa Girl and Marfa Girl 2 that was like reflective of old notebooks that you revisited?
Possibly.
Because I seem to remember, it's like when Marfa Girl 1 came out, I'm allowed to remember things. The artist is the creator. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to remember stuff. I can sometimes do that for you. But when Marfa Girl 1 came out, we actually published a facsimile of Larry's notebook that he was keeping in his pocket.
Yeah, exactly.
The process
yeah
of Marfa
yeah
Girl.
Yeah. And I shot the movie from that notebook.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
So, and of course that notebook went in the archive, but then I guess this is sort of like the Uruburu, that it's like a self-referential circle, because we did publish a facsimile of that notebook as almost like an archival publication, mm-hmm. which was also kind mm-hmm. of fun.
Yeah. And I think one thing about looking back is it gives you ideas, you know. Martha Girl 2, I had no script at all. I just made it up as I went along, you know, and it was so much fun.
And you didn't even write dialogue in the evenings like you did on Martha Girl 1. Or did you do that?
I think I got about four in the morning and I wrote dialogue, yeah. And but it's just fun. It's so much fun.
The other thing that I think is worth bringing up about your work as an artist, you know, whether you are doing collages in the space like you've done at Loring Augustine and that you've done in museums around the world, mm-hmm. or where the books, and I'm thinking specifically about the book Punk Picasso and the book Perfect Childhood, where, you know, those books have like a real serious archival component to them, mm-hmm. is that you're creating this non-linear narrative of your own life experience, pulling archival elements in. When you put together Punk Picasso, how big of a pool of materials did you have to work with, and how did you filter those?
Everything that was around, you know, I used.
And was it like just like a random act? Did you pull this piece from here, this piece from there, or?
I just looked at stuff and put it in. I think I don't remember really. But, I remember my my girlfriend at the time told me that I had to put certain things in, that if I was going to do this to other people, that I had to do it to myself. So that's why Punk Picasso gets really, really personal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even more so than Perfect Childhood, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, in all of the years that I have known you, I have also come to the realization that all your art is hyper-personal and unfiltered, in a way. You know, you're like the healthy apple cider vinegar of artists. Always unfiltered. Always sharp, always real.
Yeah. But your process as an archivist.
It's my process.
You got like hundreds of boxes, all my boxes in a space, and then what happens next?
There's one element of it that's totally like sifting, you know, sifting seawater, trying to find plankton for nutrition, like no doubt, mm-hmm. because like in a box where you haven't bothered throwing away like an entire year of New Yorker, I will find like the most illuminating little scraps of notepaper where an idea germinated that became an exhibition or mm-hmm. that became a painting or that became a photograph or whatever it is. And that it's, you know, as an archivist, to date I have placed around 130 archives with different institutional libraries and museums around the world. This is how I pay the rent. I find stuff, I organize it, I conceptualize it, and then I present it to museums and special collections. And it's unbelievably fun, and it's a great honor, but also my entire professional role is of being as invisible as possible. That's really, really important. Obviously, the editor or the curator is never completely impossible, even if we want he or she to be, because, you know, you just can't do it. So when I'm working with you, and the thing that has been so gracious in us doing this for so many years is that I can gain more and more, you know, the respect for your work was there from the first second, but more and more insight into it and more insight into the process means that me and my coworkers can be hyper diligent and really, really careful about what we find and how mm-hmm. we organize it. This is something that's debated all of the time in our field. I teach a yearly class at Rare Book School where I'll have a room full of super smart special collections librarians ready to kick my ass on my method and ready to make me question my method and attempt to improve it. In the past, I've also, I taught a master's class at Yale a number of years ago, which was really, really fun, because then you have a room full of, you know, grad students, and they really want your scalp hanging from their belt. And they would really question my process in a really hardcore way, because my process is not necessarily a academic museum level process. I should state that. When we're handling your prints, of course we have the white gloves on. But when we're handling a box of old issues of the New Yorker, there are no white gloves anywhere to be seen, and we are sifting through these vast amounts of material really quickly initially for a first pass. And you know, the funny thing is, we're actually in the middle of a first pass on your archive right now. I rented a separate space in Lower Manhattan so that Larry could come in and visit and work with the materials as we are organizing the materials. And you come down with like great frequency, and it's pretty amazing, I think.
Yeah, it's fun. So,
that one thing that I should mention that is the opposite but also related to your process and our process, is for years I worked with one of my absolute heroes, the artist and filmmaker and photographer Jonas Mikas, who recently passed away. Jonas is one of the biggest badasses I've ever met in this life. He passed away at the age of 97. He was a camp survivor. He pretty much more or less single-handedly midwifed American alternative and underground cinema as we know it, and has created a body of work and a legacy on multiple layers. It's almost difficult to comprehend the importance of this man and his graciousness and kindness. Anyway, so Jonas is totally great. And as a self-archivist, he's even worse than you. Because Jonas was consumed by what my favorite historian, the Italian historian Piero Camporesi, who was the professor of history at the University of Bologna, and who specialized in early modern Europe, which is like a personal field of interest for mine. Piero Camporesi would refer to it as the dreadful desire to study. That is what he would call it when the creator of a cultural legacy or a cultural narrative is really, really into studying his or her own work. Who are we kidding? It's always his. So Jonas would constantly self-archive and self-organize. And I was over at his apartment a couple of days ago visiting with his son, Sebastian, and we were talking about this genius mess in this 3,000 square foot loft and how to deal with it, because Jonas really liked putting things in boxes and putting the labels on the boxes. And sometimes he would get to the letter B in sub-organizing a specific kind of archive. Sometimes he would get to the letter F and the letter G in sub-organizing like some sort of archive. And then comes that dynamic moment where the world of academics and me as some sort of, I don't know, guerrilla archivist collide. Because of course there is a value in how Jonas Mikas attempted to self-organize his archives that one can kind of think should be preserved, but which is almost impossible to preserve. With you, it is much, much easier because we have these hundreds and hundreds of banker's boxes of the most majestically significant, important materials. But we can actually go through these tens of thousands of vintage prints and organize signed prints, organized edition prints, vintage prints, outtakes, and start getting a system in place where we can do notebooks and we can do personal papers, business records, publications, and so forth. So that's a process. But with Jonas, it's actually impossible. I think I'm asking the room, what do I do when this process starts? So are you sensing now that as we're in the middle of the trenches of this process that it's informing your work?
I'm anxious to get back to the city and do something today.
Yeah. We can certainly do that.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna. I'm gonna switch. Does anybody have like a completely urgent question for the great Larry Clark? Go for it. Are you talking about Jonas or Larry? With Larry, it's delightfully chaotic, so I don't have to worry about that. With Jonas, this is like a focal concern. With Larry, our methodology is very, very traditional, is identifying holograph manuscripts, separating out notepads and notebooks, getting the chronology in order, going through publications, if there is holograph notations by the author in them, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. And that's pretty much the process that I've always gone through in whatever archive that I've worked with. I don't think it would have helped anybody. It would probably have irritated you.
What describe?
If I would have like photographed every aspect of your loft when we started the process.
You should have, I think.
You should have? All right, I blew it. I admit. All right, should I talk a little bit about Joe?
Yeah,
yep. All right. Larry Clark, everybody.
All right. Yep.
So I have been involved with the special collections at the Cornell University Library for years and years and years. I think Catherine and Anne and I met 14 years ago, something like that?
2006.
I used to be a big fancy record executive for record companies like Warner Brothers and Atlantic Records and so forth in the 90s. And didn't seem to be that plausible a way of making a living when the digital music revolution started kicking into gear. So I wanted to do something different. I had trained as a historian at university, and I had also, in my capacity as a record executive, worked with a lot of historical, you know, like fancy schmancy boxed sets. I worked on the Ornette Coleman boxed set, on the Charlie Patton box set, on like numerous sort of historical anthologies like that. And I had seen some pretty horrific disasters happen as far as historical preservation goes. Stuff getting thrown into dumpsters, stuff getting thrown into rivers. All of Fela Kuti's personal filing cabinets at Calcutta Republic being lost forever. Enormous amounts of Bob Marley documents being lost forever. And this is almost too messed up to even remember, but 60 hours of perfectly recorded classic quartet John Coltrane getting lost forever with no backup copies. So I'd always been really, really interested in the early history of blues and the early history of jazz, as in, you know, in the 1910s, 1920s, leading up to Delta Blues, leading up to, you know, 1917 and the original Dixieland Jazz Band and so forth. So hip-hop was and is an absolute passion of mine. And I thought that it would be a novel idea to try to preserve this narrative as best as I possibly could while people were still around and before stuff had been thrown into dumpsters or dumped into rivers or, you know, some person in New Jersey didn't pay the storage space fee for the 60 hours of John Coltrane tapes. So in the late 90s, I started working really hard on putting together a archive on the early history of hip-hop and utilized my training as a historian and my obnoxious curiosity as trying to find as many artifacts as possible. Because, you know, it's tricky with hip-hop because it was never a self-documenting cultural narrative like punk. Punk was always completely invested with its own self-importance, where hip-hop was always about Saturday night. And when Saturday night passed by, it was the next Saturday night. And that meant that last Saturday night was the past. It was something old. And, you know, hip-hop will always be about box fresh and always about new ideas and forward thinking and the next thing. And that becomes tricky when you really, really want people to consider the, you know, the way back machine and the past. So luckily enough, I managed to gain the trust and the cooperation with numerous members of the community of original MCs, original DJs, original producers, so I could gather these materials. And I also paid cash, and I also got receipts. Because in some instances, people had certainly come and wanted to get the materials, but they wanted, you know, really, really broke people to donate them. I had a good nickname in the South Bronx. I was known as the ATM. I just found a box of old hip-hop flyers. I'm going to go to the ATM and cash them in. My brother is getting rid of his DJ rig and DJ record collection. I'm going to go down to the ATM. It sounds facetious, but the important part of that and in that communication was that I was very, very clear that I wasn't a collector and that what we were trying to amass was the foundation for a devoted historical archive on hip-hop and hip-hop culture. I met Catherine and Anne in 2006, and this was after I had met with numerous special collections libraries all over the East Coast who in some instances refused to archive outright, and in a couple of instances said that they would accept the archive if I donated it and also wrote a gigantic check. The biggest problem with building this archive, and what now brings us to Joe Conso, who can't be here today because he recently had surgery, he's doing great, but he could absolutely not travel, was that I'd made it very, very vocal in my journeys uptown that there was no photography of the truly early days of hip-hop. There were great, great photographers who shot hip-hop. You know, you have like the Jamel Shabazz's and Martha Cooper's and Henry Chalfont, but they all showed up a little bit later. They showed up as the transition of hip-hop from a performance-based culture to a recording-based culture had already kicked into gear. This is, we're talking like maybe like 82, 83. I wanted to see images of the early years. So via Grandmaster Caz, who most of us know as the guy who wrote the rhymes that the Sugar Hill Gang used for Rapper's Delight, you know, Hotel Motel Holiday Inn is a Grandmaster Caz creation, not a Sugar Hill Gang creation. I was introduced to Joe Conso. And Joe started as a photographer in the South Bronx at the age of 16 in 1978. Correction, 1977. This photograph is from 1977, and it's Joe starting to figure out how to use a camera and shooting his environment. This is 1978. This is Joe Conso beaming with pride over his accumulating skill as a photographer. Joe went to Norman Thomas High School in the South Bronx, and a couple of his classmates were Grandmaster Kaz and Easy AD from the Cold Crush Brothers. And the Cold Crush Brothers are extraordinary in the history of hip-hop because the Cold Crush Brothers in 1979 could sell 3,000 tickets anywhere in the tri-state area without having a record out, without getting any press, without getting any radio play. Because one of the things to remember about hip-hop is for the first 10 years of the history of hip-hop, it was solely a performance-based culture. The record business was not involved. The record business, the media wasn't involved. There was no radio play. There were no articles in newspapers. There was nothing. The only thing there was live performances and word of mouth. So Joe became the Cold Crush Brothers photographer. And not only the Cold Crush Brothers photographer, but because of his access to the scene, he would be invited to all of the jams, all of the hip-hop jams. This is actually a very, very famous photograph because, of course, Chris Rock used this as the backdrop for the opening of his film, CB4. And this is the Cold Crush Brothers actually performing at Norman Thomas High School. And Joe is there with his camera night after night. This is the DJ crew of the Cold Crush Brothers. And all of these photographs survived almost out of luck. Joe, like many other people of his era, spiraled into crack in the 1980s and was actually homeless briefly. But his entire photographic archive was safe kept by his grandmother. So we had thousands and thousands of photographs from the early days of hip hop. And why these photographs became so important was not only that you had a photograph of ECAD in his Adidas tracksuit, but the gentleman in the striped shirt standing to your right, my left, is the only photograph that we've been able to identify by a important pioneer of early hip-hop, Disco King Mario. And to date, this is the only photograph that we have of him. So the gathering of metadata based on these photographs becomes a matter of serious scholarly traction as well. If you look at the young man with his finger in his mouth, that's Crazy Legs from the Rocksteady Crew. Pre-fame. And Joe Konsa is there. He's there for all of the significant events in the early history of hip-hop. This is the Cold Crush Brothers signing a contract with Charlie Ahern for what is considered the greatest film on the early days of hip-hop, the film Wild Style. Charlie Ahern's Wild Style archive resides at the Special Collections Library at Cornell University as well. This is one of the earliest photographic documentations that we have of hip-hop moving into Lower Manhattan, and hip-hop performers started interacting with the punk and new wave crowd at nightclubs such as Negril. And I'm not going to do it now, but when you go through this bunch of people hanging out, there's Charlie Ahern sitting on the floor yet again. When you go through these people in the background and who they actually are, they are significant visual artists, performing musicians, cultural writers of the time. So you get this extraordinary document of where people actually met up and who actually met up as well in the context of the Joe Konsa archive. And Joe also shot his environment, and he shot his environment well, because of course, you know, in 2019 you will see all kinds of slum pornography photography, and you know, like all of those people who would come and do those picturesque photographs of Detroit as it was falling apart and so forth. But the difference is that, you know, this is where Joe lived, and this is Joe's community, and this is a street jam that he attended. And this is his home. He's going clothing shopping on a Saturday afternoon in, I don't even know if that is Harlem or the Bronx. And also because of Joe's legacy from his mother and grandmother's side, he is involved in community activism and in protests throughout the Bronx. This is, of course, the protest that was staged during the filming of the famous Fort Apache movie. And this is Joe's first published photograph as a photographer. New York Post published this photograph of Paul Newman during the demonstration against Fort Apache. Joe is and was also like an arty art school kind of guy who would like experiment with photographing ladies that, you know, sometimes he crushed on, sometimes he didn't. And he would shoot street photography, but we have to remember that this is all from a teenager's perspective. He is shooting these images when he's 16, 17, 18 years old. And the aesthetic choices that he is making as a participant in this community, which is really important to stress. And this is the Bronx in the 70s. You know, slumlords set buildings on fire. This was like five blocks from Joe's house. And the community activism is completely integrated into Joe's work and Joe's family legacy. And then we get to the other legacy, which is almost miraculous, that is another aspect of Joe Conso's life. Joe's dad, Joe Conso Sr., whose archive I'm working on right now, managed Tito Puente, which is completely bananas. So not only was Joe Conso like a first-person eyewitness of hip-hop as it was being invented, he is also there at the after-hours parties with Ray Barreto. He's standing on stage with Tito Puente. He is hanging out with Celia Cruz at the movie theater. This is Joe Conso Sr., Joe's dad. And Joe, as an 18, 19-year-old, and I'm totally jealous, gets to go to these after-hours joints uptown to see Tito Puente jam with Eddie Palmieri and Charlie Palmieri. And so there is also this absolutely extraordinary fly on the wall, non-professional photographer with some pretty great skills, access on Latin music in New York as it's truly exploding. And this is, of course, you know, I picked a selection of 30-something images of Joe's work in the 70s and 80s. And Joe is photographing to this day, and he is depositing his digital archives at Cornell University as, you know, once every few months, once every year, or something like that. And the other thing that was just announced was, of course, the new portal showcasing a really, really deep assortment of Joe's photography within the Cornell portal. Yeah, let's hear it for Joe Conso.
Let's hear it for Johan, who also brought Larry to us. So, extra quadruple thanks to you for doing that. I'm sure Joe will be proud to know that you represented his work. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Tony and Bill, for the afternoon. So we're out of time, but I just wanted to thank everybody for coming and to say, in, you know, I could summarize today, but that would take about an hour and a half. So let me just say in 2 minutes that I remember Katie said when we were organizing this, like, I hope by the end of the day we find out what an archive is. So I think that we found out several things, but among them are the fact that an archive isn't like this box that's in a dusty closet somewhere, but archives, at least in the best sense of them being used, are living, breathing documents that are open to intervention, to interpretation, to uses that you've seen many examples of today, which are like outstanding examples of how an archive can inform the way we look at life today, the way that different communities interact with things. So archives are living documents full of contingent meanings. As if we want to go with this, you know, anthropomorphic idea of them living, it's like they're also in their infancy in the sense that people are still discovering ways in which we can think about them, the way we can use them, the way they can be expanded. You know, living documents connected to living people. We found that out today too. And despite their relative in infancy, we've also, I think, found out that that archives are not entirely innocent. That is to say, that what they, in some cases, document, who controls them, how they get used, are all decisions or issues that have meanings culturally, socially, politically, and those of us that work with archives have to be attentive to the way in which we are serving as custodians, as Dominique said, as people who are actually caring for something for somebody else. So I think those are some of my takeaways. I hope everybody else had their own takeaways and that we will be able to discuss this in the future. Thanks to our online streamers in the back, and thanks to all our online audience, if such a thing can be conceived of. And thanks to all of you. Thanks to the Johnson Museum. You all know who you are. And the end.